Going to be reading from a lecture. It's fully scripted, as they say, and I'm afraid I've got to do this because there are lots of quotations in it, and there's no way that I can remember all of these quotations, but they're quite important to move along the narrative and to explain certain things. And I should also say, in the spirit of transparency, that this lecture began life as a tribute to Raoul Hilberg. I was invited to the University of Vermont, where Raoul Hilberg had been professor of history and had pioneered Holocaust studies for many, many, many years. And I thought about stripping out some of the stuff about Raoul Hilberg, which would also have mercifully made it shorter. But then I thought, no. Hilberg is a crucially important figure in the study of the fate of the Jews of the Nazi period. He also had a particular experience in the Second World War that I will begin with. And I think that that helps to set the tone for what follows. It's going to be a typical academic and scholarly lecture. I hope it will manage to keep you awake, and I hope it will, certainly hope it will be informative. But you may wonder, what is the particular and specific relevance, and why give this particular lecture on a Holocaust Memorial Day event? The reason is that it's about the course of the Second World War and the way in which the fate of the Jews was entangled in operational, strategic, tactical decisions during the war. This is something that I develop in a book that I hope will be published in September, later this year. It's one strand of an attempt to rethink the fate of the Jews between 1933 and 1945. And it is, I think, something that is extremely relevant to the present. It has been said, no Hitler, no Holocaust. I think that is probably true. Less self-evident is the proposition, no war, no Holocaust. No war, no genocide. I would argue that without the Second World War, the fate of the Jews would have been radically different. And I think all the evidence since 1945, subsequent genocides, atrocities, and we heard about a few mentioned earlier, all of those atrocities and genocides were linked to, took place within the context of civil war or interstate warfare. And that is going on as we speak. While it is important, of course, specifically with respect to the fate of the Jews, to think about anti-Semitism and racism, eugenics, without war, the fate of the Jews would have been fundamentally different. And I would suggest that we need to think much more carefully about the linkage between war, warfare, atrocity, and genocide. But now I'm going to talk specifically about the Second World War and the fate of the Jews. In one of the most striking passages in his memoir, The Politics of Memory, The Journey of a Holocaust Historian, Raoul Hilberg recalls his experiences as a precocious 18-year-old German Jewish refugee inducted into the United States Army and dispatched to Europe in the closing months of the Second World War. Writing with his customary tone of wry self-deprecation, he distinguishes his record of military service from that of other servicemen, men who were shelled at Anzio, who waded ashore on Omaha Beach. But one battle experience was imprinted on his mind. This is what he writes from his very wonderful memoir, and all budding historians should read it. It was April 1945 in Bavaria. I looked at a field bathed in the sun,
During the night, the Germans had attempted to assault our lines. Our machine gunners had mowed them down. All over the field, the bodies of Germans lay motionless, rifles stuck in the ground to mark their location. One corpse was on its back, its eye sockets filled with blood. What, I asked myself, could have compelled these men at this late stage of the war to run into almost certain death? That question, his curiosity about the perpetrators, was to guide his life's work. However, despite his personal exposure to the war, his participation in an army intelligence course once he was back in the United States, the war is one of the most notable absences from his oeuvre. And I'll remind you, Raoul Hilberg is considered one of the founders of Holocaust studies, a major figure who anyone studying the subject has to grapple with. But the definitive 1985 edition of his great work, The Destruction of the European Jews, doesn't include Stalingrad, Sicily, or Normandy in the index. Kursk is mentioned, but as the place where a Jewish community was slaughtered, not a crucial battle on the Eastern Front in July 1943. The start of the war is encompassed in seven limpid words when the German army moved into Poland, as if the Wehrmacht had engaged in a bloodless manoeuvre. His discussion of the Madagascar plan in mid-1940,
that was the plan to round up European Jews and send them to the island of Madagascar,
his discussion of this concludes that it faded. He doesn't explain that the plan to ship 4 million Jews to a tropical island off the coast of East Africa was rendered unfeasible because the British controlled the sea lanes and Germany proved unable to defeat Britain. The extent of his account of the invasion of the Soviet Union is limited to just that, the invasion of the Soviet Union. He says nothing about the course of the conflict or the operations of the German army. The Wehrmacht is treated simply as part of the machinery of destruction. Perhaps most curiously, he writes of the Wannsee Conference held on the 20th of January 1942, but originally scheduled for the 9th of December 1941, that it was, in his words, postponed at the last minute. He doesn't mention that the delay was caused by Pearl Harbor and Hitler's decision to declare war on the United States. Yet historians today regard that juncture as vital in understanding the trigger for the final solution. Hitler had stated on the 30th of January 1939 that if the Jews plunged Germany into a global war, they would pay the price. In December 1941, the war became a global conflict. And yet, Hilberg does not make this connection, not even in the final revised and updated edition of his masterwork. Now, this isn't to say that Raoul Hilberg entirely ignored the military conflict. He didn't. In his path-breaking research on the German railways, he drew attention to the demands of the war and noted that because of wartime conditions, timetables for special trains carrying Jews to the death camps were frequently subject to alteration. He pointed out that the Allied landings in North Africa shook up the political equilibrium in Vichy France, causing the Germans to occupy the free zone, and I'll say more about that later. In a typical understatement, he observed that in mid-1943, the military situation did not exactly change in Germany's favour. But the surrender of Italy opened up new territories to the Nazi Jew hunters. And Hilberg connected Hungary's desire to get out of the Axis coalition in 1944 as a direct response to Germany's military defeats with Hitler's decision to occupy the country and ravage its Jewish population. So I haven't made these points in order to knock Raoul Hilberg. His work is a bedrock of our scholarship today. I mention it because it's typical of the historiography of the period throughout which he worked. From the late 1940s until the late 1980s, historians of the Jewish catastrophe treated the war in the most perfunctory way, while, at the same time, during this period, military historians ignored the fate of the Jews altogether. When the war did provide a frame of reference for historians exploring the tragedy of the Jews, the approach was often reductive or very narrowly focused. Hence, Lucy Davidovits treated the Second World War as the war against the Jews. In her narrative, Hitler's militancy was driven by his malice towards Jews, his campaigns were subordinate to his anti-Semitism, and both synced with the invasion of the USSR in June 1941. Arno Mayer triggered controversy with his polemic, "Why Did the Heavens Not Darken?" when he reduced Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union, to a crusade against Jewish Bolshevism and attributed the final solution to Hitler's peak when his armies ground to a halt even before they reached the gates of Moscow. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, a great deal of ink was spilled over the question of whether Hitler launched the genocide against Europe's Jews amidst the euphoric victory in the late summer of 1941, as Chris Browning maintains, or whether it was planned before this, as Richard Brightman insists, or whether it pivoted on the end of the year for reasons which we have already heard, the declaration of war on the United States. Military historians, for their part, chronicled the war as if it had no connection with the fate of European Jews. The standard work by Basil Littlehart, published in 1970 and still in print, does not have the word Jews in the index. Total War, Causes and Course of the Second World War by Peter Culver-Caressi and Guy Vint, which appeared in 1974, submerged the deportation and massacre of Jewish populations in a section on repression and liquidation that covered the suffering of all peoples in German-occupied Europe. And Alan Clark's celebrated account of Operation Barbarossa devotes more space to the development of the Panzer Mark V tank than the slaughter of 1.5 million Soviet Jews. There is a chapter entitled Slaughter in the Ukraine, but it concerns the Battle of Kiev in September 1941, rather than Babi Yar, which took place just a few days after the conclusion of that battle. And you will not find the term war crimes in Alan Clark's index. The first military historian to integrate Nazi ideology and anti-Semitism into analysis of the war was Gerhard Weinberg. In A World at Arms, A Global History of World War II, published in 1994, Weinberg explained the role of Nazi racism and anti-Jewish policies in their preparations for warfare and the way in which the Germans conducted their campaigns from the conquest of Poland onwards. He made the point, already established, it has to be said, by German historians, that the mass murder of civilians with the complicity of the Wehrmacht, the German army, was integral to the planning of Operation Barbarossa. And he demonstrated that the persecution of the Jews was a key element in relations between the Axis states, commingling with conventional strategic priorities. Weinberg also explored Allied responses to information about the final solution and placed the question of rescue in the context of strategic and operational decisions. And I am going to refer to that also later on. Now, I'm glad to say that it's almost standard practice today for even hardcore military historians like Anthony Beevor and Max Hastings to include a discussion of Hitler's ideology, Nazi genocidal policies, and their implementation in comprehensive histories of the conflict. And it will be alarming if they didn't, because since the 1990s, a small library of books has appeared on the mass murder of Jews, in the conception and the execution of Operation Barbarossa, and on the crimes of the Wehrmacht especially. Whether they managed successfully to integrate the fate of the Jews within the operational dimension, strategy, tactics, is another matter. Ostkrieg, a recent narrative of the war in the East by the American military historian Stephen Fritz, is perhaps the first to relate strategic decisions and operational developments to the murderous handling of Jewish civilians in occupied Poland, the USSR, and ultimately the whole of Europe. And I urge everybody to read Stephen Fritz's book, which is a superb and gripping narrative. Sadly,
I think historians whose focus is primarily on the Jewish tragedy have done less to engage with either the macrocosmic dimension or the minutiae of warfare. One of the few attempts to do so is the fascinating collection of essays edited by Asher Cohen, Yehoyakim Kochavi, and Yoav Gelber back in 1992, entitled The Shoah and the War. This offers a rare insight into the interrelation between the conduct of the war and the destruction of the Jews, which is their mission statement. The collection was triggered by the 50th anniversary of the outbreak of the war. And I think it's astonishing that it has not had any successor or spawned any significant research of a comparable nature. Instead, most of the work by Holocaust historians has remained focused on periods and places treated in almost complete isolation from the wider conflict. The failure to connect the war and anti-Jewish policy is all the more surprising given the intensity with which Jews, during the war, focused on its development, followed the campaigns in every theatre. Now, we tend to think that the Jewish people in German-occupied Europe, especially those in ghettos, as cut off from the outside world, starved of food and information. But in fact, even in the most hermetically sealed ghetto, such as the Lodz or Łódź ghetto, Jews were able to follow the course of the war blow by blow. They were not only able to get information, they were able to analyse it using quite sophisticated tools. Most middle-aged Jews had already lived through one world war. Those in Eastern Europe had lived through the Great War and a succession of lesser conflicts. Many Jewish men fought in the 1914-1918 conflict, and younger males had since then done military service. So they had a rich store of knowledge to draw upon, in addition to what they could glean from German military bulletins, from BBC radio news broadcasts, and what they saw with their own eyes. So in the rest of my lecture, I want to show just how closely and perceptively Jews monitor the progress of both the Axis and the Allies. I want to illustrate how, even though they were immured in fortress Europe, they were able to reach shrewd prognoses as to the likely outcome of the titanic confrontations in the East and the West, at sea and in the air. Crucially, they connected the dimensions of time and space in the prosecution of the war with their own fate. They understood what military historians and historians of the Jewish faith have not made clear enough, that Jewish survival was a race against time, that time and distance were dynamically related, and that Jewish existence hinged on operational choices by the Axis and by the Allies. For the Jews of Poland in May 1940, news that Germany had invaded the Low Countries and attacked France was greeted with immense excitement. We know from his diary that Adam Czerniakow, the chairman of the Jewish Council in Warsaw, followed the campaign in France almost day by day. Chaim Kaplan, a Hebrew scholar and a teacher in Warsaw, recorded that news of the fighting in the West gave hope to the Jews in Warsaw and throughout German-occupied Poland. They were hopeful because no one expected the Germans to win a military showdown with the two most powerful empires in the world. The speed and the totality with which the Germans defeated the British and the French armies, a victory that was more due to the incompetence of Allied commanders than the brilliance of their opponents, surprised the Germans as much as anyone else. Victor Klemperer, a non-Aryan Christian living with his non-Jewish wife in a Jew's house in Dresden, found the course of events incomprehensible. Emanuel Ringelblum in Warsaw reported that the populace is enveloped in deep melancholy. According to Chaim Kaplan, the fall of Paris occasioned weeping and wailing amongst Jewish Varsovians. However, Emil Dorian, a Jewish doctor in Bucharest, reached a very
different conclusion. Although he too was shattered by the news that German troops had entered the City of Light, Paris, a beacon to most cultured Romanians, the following day he wrote in his diary, "Where will Hitler get oil, grain, tin, copper, and all the other raw materials imported from the French colonies?" Dorian predicted that if Russia and America refused to supply the Third Reich, and England continued to resist, Hitler's ambitions for global conquest would be thwarted. Now, this was a stunning insight. Churchill's refusal to surrender, and the inability of the Germans either to launch an invasion or subdue British resistance by aerial bombardment, left Hitler with a painful dilemma. Even though Stalin continued to supply the Reich with mineral oil, grain, and raw materials, these imports were not enough to sustain the German voracious war economy and feed the German population at the same time, not to mention the burden of support for the Reich's needy Axis partners and the obligation to feed the inhabitants of occupied Western Europe. Hitler knew that unless he found a way to end the war quickly, German industry would soon run short of raw materials, the military would have to draw on stocks of fuel and lubricants, while famine would threaten Europe. The Soviet Union emerged as the key to unlocking this predicament. Hitler believed that Britain would throw in the towel if the USSR was smashed. As well as destroying the threat of Jewish Bolshevism, a victorious campaign in the East would leave the Reich in possession of vast agricultural regions that would feed the German population and supply grain to Germany's clients. It would give German industry access to nearly unlimited natural resources, and it would lead to control of the largest oil fields in Europe, putting Germany in a position to challenge the United States of America for global supremacy. Stalin may not have believed reports that Germany was preparing to strike eastwards, but Polish Jews saw the signs. As early as September 1940, Chaim Kaplan divined the Tripartite Pact, signed by Germany, Italy, and Japan, signified that Hitler was laying the groundwork for an attack on the USSR. In May 1941, Emanuel Ringelblum, now leading the great project Onyx Shabbat to collect documents chronicling the experience of Jews, particularly in Warsaw under the occupation, Ringelblum observed that the general government, the portion of occupied Poland not annexed to the Reich, the general government was so packed with German troops that the price of foodstuffs had rocketed. Indeed, as Poland became a vast staging area for the German armed forces preparing for the invasion of Russia, factories and workshops in the ghettos experienced boom times. Anton Cherniakov noted at the start of June 1941 that the military administration had ordered air raid precautions in Warsaw. On the 18th of June, several days prior to the invasion, David Serakoviak, a 19-year-old living in the Lodz ghetto, reckoned that the anti-communist campaign in the German-language newspapers presaged the renunciation of the German-Soviet pact. The start of Operation Barbarossa brought a surge of hope to Jews across the continent. Serakoviak reported that everybody feels that a chance for liberation is finally possible. Ringelblum spotted V for victory graffiti appear all over Warsaw, expressing the widespread belief in a Soviet victory. In the unoccupied zone of Vichy France, Raymond Raoul Lambert, a veteran of the trenches and a Jewish communal activist, observed that everyone looks happy. French men and women recalled 1812 and wished that Napoleon's fate would be visited on Hitler. Lambert wrote in his journal, "The mirage of the East has always been the downfall of conquerors." Like most denizens of Jewish Warsaw, Cherniakov tracked the progress of the German armies with anxiety. not least because his son had fled to the Russian-occupied area of Poland in 1939 and settled in Lvov, which fell to the Germans at the start of July 1941. Most Jews in Poland had relatives in a similar situation, so the weeks during which the German advance seemed unstoppable were especially tense. However, by late July, the German army had run into stiffening resistance. Ringelblum noted, "The Soviet army's stand is amazing the Jewish population. Now that the Russians have held out for 7 weeks, the belief is growing that they will eventually liberate us from the German occupation." And indeed, the German high command was now facing the first of a succession of operational and logistic crises on the Eastern Front. Raymond Raoul Lambert, drawing on his experience of the Great War and extracting every morsel that he could from the German military bulletins, discerned this predicament. He wrote in his journal, "It's the first time Hitler hasn't had success with his blitzkrieg. I really think that this time the fortunes of the Nazi conquerors will turn. Besides, America is practically in the war now on the British side." Although the fall of Kiev in September 1941 and the renewed German advance again depressed the Jewish population, some perceptive observers realized that the situation for the Germans was not all rosy. Lambert correctly diagnosed the failure of Operation Barbarossa. It was now simply too late in the year for Hitler to achieve the decisive victory he needed. After agonizing weeks in which they had charted German advances, Polish Jews had the satisfaction of seeing the Germans turn to them for fur garments that could be rushed to badly equipped troops on the Eastern Front. The fur action, as it was called, in December 1941, was carried out with the customary German brutality and left many Jews facing an exceptionally severe winter without warm outer clothing. But it created a warm inner glow for what it signified, Hitler's first defeat. In his annual roundup on the last day of the war, Emil Dorian in Bucharest reproduced an old Romanian saying, "There are holes in the devil's boots." Jews in Europe were not only pinning their hopes on the Red Army. Throughout 1941, they followed the waxing and waning fortunes of the British 8th Army in North Africa and the disastrous British campaign in Greece. According to Rabbi Shimon Huberband, a member of Ringelblum's Oneg Shabbat group, there was a saying in the ghetto that Germany is waging a war, England is playing a game, Germany will win the war, but England will win the game. After the British staged yet another evacuation from the Greek mainland, this time, Ringelblum transcribed a joke that was going the rounds in the Warsaw ghetto. "If the Germans win the war, 25% of the Jews will die. If the English win, 70% will die. That's how long the English victory will take." Now, this witticism was tragically accurate. At this stage in the war, mid-1941, a quick German victory would probably have resulted in fewer Jewish deaths than a long, drawn-out Allied victory. The Jews had no doubt that the British would eventually triumph, but they sensed that they were working to a very different timetable. Huberband captured this awareness in another ghetto gag. A German asked an Englishman, "On what do you base your optimism that England will emerge victorious? Do you have a huge army like the German army?" The Englishman replied, "No." "Do you have a powerful air force like the German air force?" And the Englishman replied, "No." "Well," asked the exasperated German, "do you have enough ammunition?" To which the Englishman replied, "No." "Then what do you have enough of?" the German asked. "We," said the Englishman, "have enough time." This was a very shrewd observation, and I'll develop in a moment why time was so crucial, and I'll also explain why
in mid-1941, the fate of the Jews was not necessarily what it will become towards the end of that year. Jews in Europe also monitored every utterance and act by President Roosevelt, longing for the moment that America would enter the war. Both David Stereokoviak and Victor Klemperer took heart from the US occupation of Iceland in June 1941. They were even aware of the American occupation of Iceland. And President Roosevelt's affirmation of support for the democracies. When Roosevelt made a speech about the war, they got the gist of it. To Klemperer, this signalled that America was at last assuming the role of a world power. Raymond Raoul Lambert was cheered by Roosevelt's words. "One thing is certain," he wrote in his journal, "Hitler fears the moment when America, already virtually at war and in possession of two-thirds of the gasoline in the world, will be finished equipping itself to intervene effectively in Europe." In the following month, Stereokoviak connected the midsummer stalemate on the Eastern Front, 1941, with global developments. "The US is now almost totally ready for war with Germany. England is bombing, and there have been no new German conquests on the front." However, the Jews were apprehensive that every move America took towards war would be attributed to them. In the wake of the Lend-Lease Agreement, Emil Dorian commented, "The official German press immediately found out who the culprits were, the American Jews. According to the German newspapers, US aid will not help the Jews in Europe. They will pay with new suffering for American Jewry's hateful gesture." When America finally became a fully fledged combatant, a burst of optimism pulsed through Europe's Jews. Mary Berg, whose actual name was Mary Buttenberg, in the Warsaw Ghetto, reported that, in her diary, "American entry into the war has inspired the hundreds of thousands of dejected Jews with a new breath of hope. Most people believe that the war will not last long now that the Allies' victory is certain." In his entry for the last entry for 1941, Lambert rejoiced that "these last days of the year have seen events that will be most important for the outcome of the war, which is no longer in doubt." Of course, it would take time for America to mobilize its resources, build war machines, train men, and ship them across the Atlantic. And time was not what the Jews had. Here was the fatal intersection between strategic and operational decisions and Nazi anti-Jewish policy. America's entry into the war accelerated German thinking about solving the Jewish question and edged the Nazi elite in the direction of the most radical solution of all: physical annihilation. Moreover, Himmler and Heydrich intended to complete the extermination of the Jews of Eastern Europe by the end of 1942. The Allies did not perceive that there was now a race between their burgeoning military capacity and Germany's expanding capacity for mass murder. The operational decisions they made regarding the invasion of Europe, deferring it from 1942 to 1943 and then 1944, were to have fateful consequences for Europe's expectant Jews. As their increasingly tragic commentaries show, the Jews were acutely conscious that outcomes on the battlefield would determine their future as much as anything planned by the Nazis. The failure of the Russian counteroffensive in spring 1942 and German victories in the summer tormented Jewish observers. They were particularly disturbed by Rommel's success in North Africa and his lunge for the Suez Canal. One of the last entries in Adam Chernyakov's diary concerns the fall of Tobruk in June 1942. Chaim Kaplan, a Zionist who had visited Palestine in the 1930s, monitored developments in Libya and Egypt on a daily basis. After the German capture of Tobruk, he wrote, "Another disappointment. England has suffered a defeat and is fleeing to Egypt. And once war is in Egypt,
Who will wager that it will not spread from there to Palestine as well? A week later, he penned, Rommel is before Alexandria. Sebastopol has been captured. Where is the mighty British army? Where is the power of mighty America? Where is the Second Front? When Rommel was finally halted at the El Alamein line, Kaplan heaved a sigh of relief and shrewdly looked forward to a British counterblow. Cooped up in Warsaw, on the eve of the Great Deportations, he made an amazingly insightful analysis of the Wehrmacht at high tide. This is what he wrote. Their victories on paper make no impression. A weakening is apparent in comparison with their power and might of the last year. Chaim Kaplan did not live to see his prediction verified. He was swallowed up in the deportations and murdered in Treblinka. But many military historians, notably Robert Citino in the USA and the official German war historians, now regard the Wehrmacht's summer victories in 1942 as illusory, gifted them by foolish opponents. In reality, the German armed forces had almost no chance of recovering the strategic initiative. Time was running against them, but it was just not running fast enough to save the Jews. In southern France in June 1942, Raymond Raoul Lambert had to endure the misery of hearing the French Premier Pierre Laval dedicate his country to the policy of collaboration, with dire implications for its Jewish inhabitants. Yet the German army again looked invincible at that moment, so he concluded with resignation, "We must submit and wait, hold on and endure." The Allied landings in Morocco and Algeria, Operation Torch, combined with a stalemate on the Eastern Front in the autumn of 1942, caused him to feel optimism again. He was also cheered by what he saw with his own eyes. When the Germans occupied the Free Zone of southern France in response to the Anglo-American invasion of North Africa, he noted in his diary, "There is little military equipment in evidence. The cars are old models. The soldiers either very young or older." Like Kaplan in Warsaw, Lambert noticed that the Germans were already being worn down. They were running out of resources, equipment and manpower. He even believed that the war would end in autumn 1943. By contrast, David Sirakoviak greeted news of the Anglo-American landings in North Africa in November 1942 with a mixture of joy and frustration. After all, Marseille, which was where Lambert was living, was a lot closer to the Allied armies than Lodz in Poland. David Sirakoviak groaned that the British and the Americans were doing everything except coming here, damn them. The German defeat at Stalingrad in November 1942 stimulated fresh expectations amongst the surviving Jews across Europe. "Germany's confusion and collapse can clearly be seen," Emil Dorian wrote excitedly. "The end of the war is not far off. It may be that in April Hitler's 10 years of National Socialism will be over." In Dresden, Klemperer detected that the regime was tottering. After learning of Goebbels' speech at the Sportpalast in February 1943, blaming the Jews for every setback and pledging total war, Abraham Golub, the deputy secretary of the Jewish Council in the Kovno ghetto, reflected that, "Today we know that our enemy is on the decline, and that every day something may happen which can change the whole situation. Our redemption may come quite unexpectedly." Hermann Krück, the librarian in the Vilna ghetto, took down a ghetto joke that illustrated the resilient mood of the populace. A Jew lends the money to a German. A Lithuanian observes this and asks in amazement, "How on earth can you trust a German?" And the Jew replies, "Well, they took Stalingrad and gave it back." In all these, hopes were disappointed. German commanders on the Eastern Front staged an operationally brilliant counterattack to stabilise the situation, while the Allied advance in North Africa displayed operational naivety and tactical incompetence. Secret negotiations with the local Vichy authorities were bungled, and the assault faced serious resistance from French troops in many places. The beachheads were hundreds of miles away from the main targets, Tunis, Bizerte and Tripoli. And to the surprise of many of the Allies, Hitler airlifted troops to shield the rear of the Panzer Army Africa, Rommel's force, while weather further slowed the Allied advance. When the British vanguard reached the Tunisian frontier, it ran into strong German defensive positions. Although the Italo-German bridgehead in Tunisia was ultimately unsustainable and amounted to a strategic folly, it held up Allied progress until early 1943 and obliged the Americans to give up the idea of a cross-channel assault in 1943 and settle for the Mediterranean strategy as preferred by the British. Now, while they were not privy to the debates within the Allied coalition, Jews in Europe sensed the implications. Emil Doria noted that it took the British and the Americans 6 months to finish the job in North Africa. Hermann Krupp celebrated the ultimate defeat of the Italian-German forces in Tunisia in May 1943, but regretted the sluggishness of Allied progress. "We're running out of time," he noted. "If it lasts, we will all be killed. If something significant does happen, then perhaps, just perhaps, we might win our existence." In almost identical terms, Abraham Golob in Kovno meditated on the danger of a prolonged German defeat. "With time at their disposal," he wrote, "they will exterminate us." From expectations of an Allied invasion of Europe and a speedy end to the war, David Seriakoviak, now suffering from a multitude of ailments, was reduced to the mantra, writing in his diary, "just to get by, just to get through as long as possible, just to come closer to the end of the war." And at the other side of the continent, David Koker, a brilliant young Dutch Jew who had recently arrived in Vught concentration camp with his family, wrote in his journal about the uncertainty occasioned by the military bulletins. Koker's deportation coincided with the German evacuation of the Caucasus and the fall of Rostov, taking them back to where they started a year earlier. But when the Russians were unable to push on to Kiev, Koker wrote that the idea that the war will end soon has disappeared. After the Germans recaptured Kharkov in March 1943, he noted sourly in his journal, "We won't be out of this place for quite a while." The invasion of Sicily in July 1943, the fall of Mussolini, rekindled in Jews the exhilaration that they had enjoyed in the midst of the German calamity at Stalingrad. To Emil Dorian, the fall of the Duce was the most astounding event since the beginning of the war. Fascism in Italy just evaporated, provoking the suspicion that the same could happen everywhere, that the German example had been imitated, including in his native Romania. Kalel Perechodnik, a former member of the Jewish police in Otwock, a town southeast of Warsaw, was in hiding with his family at this point. In a memoir written during the war, he recalled how thrilled they were to get the good tidings about the Stalingrad victory. "We could not sleep the entire night for the excitement. We have the satisfaction that the war will soon be over and our suffering would end." And once again, Lambert predicted that it would all be over in the following year. Philip Mechanicus, a middle-aged Dutch Jewish journalist interned in a Westerbork concentration camp, recorded that the general view was that the war will soon be over. Was this so crazy? No, because to older people like him, it felt like 1918 all over again. Then, defeat had sparked revolution, and the fall of an emperor in Austria hastened the same cycle in Germany. So would there be a repeat performance? Mechanicus speculated, "Every week means one more week, and every week may be the last. The regime in Germany may collapse like the regime in Italy." Well, of course, the regime in Berlin did not collapse. Time ran out for Shimon Huberband, who was deported to Treblinka in August 1942. Time ran out for David Serokowiak, who died of tuberculosis in August 1943. Time ran out for Raymond Roald Lambert, who was arrested with his family in August and sent to Drancy and then shipped to Auschwitz-Birkenau in December 1943. Manuel Ringelblum escaped from the Warsaw Ghetto in April 1943 and survived in hiding for a year until his refuge was betrayed to the Germans. Hermann Krupp was transferred to the Kluge concentration camp in Estonia, where he was murdered the day before it was overrun by the Red Army in September 1944. Philipp Mechanicus was transported to Auschwitz-Birkenau in March 1944 and murdered. David Koker was relocated to Auschwitz-Birkenau as part of a special work group that perished of exhaustion, malnutrition and illness en route to Dachau in April 1945. Abraham Golub survived in hiding and later emigrated to Palestine, and Emil Dorian continued to live in Bucharest and was a leading member of the Jewish community there until his death in 1956. So let me conclude with some brief thoughts on the dynamic between warfare operational doctrine and the destruction of the European Jews. Do I have another 5 minutes or so? During the first half of the war, Jews paid the price for German military failure. The strategic and operational doctrines that had governed the German high command since the days of Frederick the Great mandated short, ruthlessly fought wars in pursuit of the single decisive victory. Germany was a medium-sized economic and military power occupying an unfavourable geostrategic location in the middle of Europe, surrounded by potential enemies, but without easily defensible natural borders. Campaigns had to be rapid and decisive, because the country could not sustain large armies in the field for a long drawn-out conflict. And this was as true for von Moltke and von Schlieffen in the Great War as it was for von Rundstedt and von Manstein in the Second World War. Hitler and his military advisers absorbed the lesson that there was no point holding back military assets if the country would be doomed in a long war, and that it was necessary to be absolutely ruthless in order to secure victory in the shortest possible time. But from the start of hostilities in 1939, they were confounded. Instead of isolating and fighting Poland, they found themselves confronted with a war on two fronts. Although it was relatively straightforward to defeat the Polish armies, in the West they faced two imperial powers with vastly greater resources. But Hitler was lucky in his enemies, and more by luck than judgment, secured an astonishing victory in the summer of 1940. As I've said, that smashing success turned out to be an illusion. Britain, with its imperial hinterland, refused to surrender, and Germany lacked the means to finish her off. Hitler proposed to solve his strategic dilemma by invading Russia, thereby denying Britain the hope of assistance from the last major land power on the continent. The German army modelled its attack on the successful campaign in the West, popularly but wrongly known as Blitzkrieg. Yet the conditions in Western Europe conducive to that style of mobile warfare simply did not obtain in Eastern Europe. Furthermore, the planning of the German general staff prior to Operation Barbarossa was remarkably slapdash. The result was a military disaster in the autumn and the winter of 1941 that condemned Germany to a war it could not win. The Jews paid the price. The preferred solution of the Jewish question from 1939 to 1941 was a combination of forced emigration and expulsion. As the Germans conquered one country after another, they hoped to exploit its territorial possessions as a dumping ground for unwanted Jews. First, a corner of occupied Poland, then French-controlled Madagascar, and finally, the land beyond the Urals. After Operation Barbarossa foundered, the Siberian solution remained a mirage. Germany's defeat in Russia in 1941, then, not only removed the option of ejecting millions of Jews from areas under German domination, it had a domino effect across the continent. Plunging morale at home led the Nazi leaders to step up actions against the German Jews. Party bosses clamoured for Jews to be deported, freeing up apartments for bombed-out German families. To make room for Reich Jews, Jews from Germany, in ghettos in the east, local Nazi rulers massacred the Polish Jews packed within their confines. In addition, the prolongation of the war led to a security crisis. Jewish civilians in occupied Russia were perceived as a security threat from the inception of Barbarossa. But as the military position worsened and German supply lines were plagued by Russian marauders, Jews became prime targets for pacification operations. And finally, military failure created a resource crisis for the German army and the home front. There was not enough food for both the men under arms and the civilian population. The shortfall was met in part by depriving the populations of Eastern Europe of food and fuel. Given Nazi racial predilections, the peoples of Poland and the USSR were condemned to the most drastic reductions in food supply. But the Jews were subjected to a policy that amounted to forced starvation. Hitler had repeatedly threatened that if Germany found itself in a world conflict, the Jews would be punished. With the German declaration of war on the United States, the war became global. Jews ceased to be hostages whose lives were held as a guarantee of American non-intervention. Instead, they became culprits who deserved sanguinary retribution. Ultimately, the course of the war, rather than decisions within the framework of anti-Jewish policy, triggered the descent into a Europe-wide genocide. Now, as we've seen, during 1942, the Jews in Europe understood that they were in a race against time. Could the Allied armies advance, cover a sufficient distance fast enough to save them from the Germans? Well, if the Jews paid the price for German military failure in the first half of the war, they paid the price for Allied military failure in the second. As we've seen, the invasion of North Africa did not lead to a rapid victory and led to delays to the invasion of Europe. What's more, the invasion of North Africa triggered a new security crisis in the Germans' minds. With Allied troops securely based in North Africa, the entire southern Mediterranean coast beckoned as a location for the second front that Stalin demanded. As a result, Jewish populations that had so far escaped the ministrations of the SS came into focus as a potential fifth column or a source of assistance for an Allied incursion. So Hitler ordered the immediate occupation of southern France and strengthened German garrisons in the Balkans. What then followed were deportations from southern France, from Marseille, and the destruction of the Jewish population in Salonika. By the time the Jews had defeated the Italian-German army in Tunisia, it was too late to contemplate a cross-channel invasion. However, with so many assets in the Mediterranean, it was impossible to do nothing. So the Allies launched an invasion of Sicily, which succeeded in 4 weeks, much longer than ought to have been the case, and then went on to invade Italy, where they became bogged down. But the invasion of Sicily and the invasion of Italy triggered the fall of Mussolini. But this, paradoxically, also had disastrous effects for the Jews, because with Italy's withdrawal from the war, the Germans marched into the Italian zones of occupation in former Yugoslavia, in southern France, and in Greece, with the result that more Jews fell into their hands. Luigi Fleischmann was a German-born teenager whose family had moved from Germany to Fiume after 1933. During the war, they were interned in a village in the Abruzzi. From there, Luigi followed the landings of the Allies at Salerno in southern Italy very closely, but soon began to doubt the speed of the Allied advance. In October 1943, he wrote in his notebook, "The Allies are taking their time." At that point, the British were just 60 miles away, but they did not reach his village until June 1944. And by that time, several Jewish families from neighboring towns had been seized by the Germans. In the end, the Anglo-American way of warfare doomed the Jews as surely as the German way of warfare. The courtesies and compromises of coalition warfare prevented bolder, more decisive moves that might have covered more ground faster. The predilection for vast material superiority required a massive lead time for every operation to allow for the long, slow build-up of men and munitions. The sheer sophistication of the Anglo-American military machine, its dependence on the internal combustion engine, made it vulnerable to supply bottlenecks, as in September 1944, when the Allied forces in France literally ran out of gas, partly leading to that fateful 6 more months of German rule over Central Europe, during which at least 250,000 Jews perished and tens of thousands more people. In April 1944, the Czech Jewish writer Oskar Rosenfeld, a contributor to the Lodz Ghetto Chronicle, wrote in his private notebook, "We are all waiting for redemption, liberation." 3 months later, he summed up the prospects as apocalypse or redemption. In August 1944, Rosenfeld was deported to Auschwitz-Birkenau, along with most of the other 70,000 Jews still in the ghetto. Hate and indifference played their part in the Jewish apocalypse, but ultimately it was the war that explains why, for millions, there was no redemption. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that fascinating talk. It's sort of kind of given me a lot to think about and rethink, I think, into your kind of main thrust. So I kind of look forward to seeing the book from this kind of analysis come out very soon. So we've got about 5 minutes to take a few questions. Do you have any questions you'd like to ask Professor Sarai? Yes.
I was struck by the comment you made when you talked about the Jewish commentator, I can't remember the name, and you said that he predicted in the German victory, he predicted that 25% of Jews would die, and in that victory, 70%. And it seems to me that that's at the core of your argument here. But in 1941, when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, the Hitler order that went out was for mass extermination.
Was it? Well, continue.
Well,
sorry.
Okay. Well, that's been my reading of it in the past. That it talked about the mass killings of doing things that were unpalatable but were required. The killing of all commissars and so forth. Mm-hmm. So there was a kind of murderous logic that was involved at that point. That's prior to the American invasion. Mm. And so it seems to me that at that point, you know much more about this than I do, it seems to me at that point that kind of murderous logic was already built in. And to take the logical sort of, see where your argument seems to be going is, had the Germans won, mm-hmm. Do you think they would have stopped the process? Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end, clearly that's what you do seem to be saying. But, you know, there was, it seems to me, by that stage, a huge commitment mm-hmm. to the destruction of the Jews.
Okay, so we are slightly in the realm of counterfactual history,
yeah.
Which is becoming a bit more respectable these days, but not completely. First of all, the orders given to the Einsatzgruppe, the mobile killing units, to other elements of the German occupation forces at the beginning of Operation Barbarossa were for very specific and targeted killings on a huge scale. But it's quite clear that initially they were shooting, on the whole, Jewish males aged from 16 to 40. The killing of entire Jewish populations doesn't begin for several weeks after the commencement of Operation Barbarossa, and some historians would argue it's a response to the security crisis and the food crisis. The Germans could have seen Jewish babies and old people as a security threat is, of course, a fantasy, but that's the way in which the leading elements of the security operation thought. There was much more logic to their anxiety about a food crisis. And we forget that, historians now reminded us that the death of nearly a million Leningraders was the deliberate result of a policy of siege and starvation. The Germans had no intention of feeding the Soviet population, Jews or non-Jews. They were going to scrounge and survive on what they could get. So the fate of the Jews can be seen in that context. Now let's look at what's going on in Germany. Jews are allowed to emigrate from Austria and the Third Reich, the Old Reich, until September 1941. They are leaving. They are allowed to emigrate. Let's look at German policy in other parts of Europe. In France, Belgium, Netherlands, there are no plans for deportations. The Jews are not marked with the star. They certainly have no inkling of what is going to come, and perhaps more to the point, neither does Adolf Eichmann. When the decisions are made to start preparing for the deportation of Jews from Western Europe, Eichmann and everybody else is running to catch up. These preparations possibly, we aren't quite sure, begin in late 1941. But they don't go into effect in practice until after the meeting of Wannsee in the spring of 1942. So the decision to actually round up and physically annihilate the Jews of the whole of Europe, or those parts under German control, most historians would now argue that decision comes much later in the war than we would have thought. So it begs the question, what would have happened if Russia had been knocked out in the late autumn of 1941? Well, German policy at that time was to extrude the Jews, to expel the Jews. There was no thought of murdering the whole Jewish population of Europe. There were no preparations for that. There were no means for doing that. They couldn't have done it.
Weren't there investigations
Well, it's arguable what those investigations and experiments with poison gas at Auschwitz and at Chelmno and elsewhere are about. Again, the consensus amongst historians is that probably those were focused on the destruction of the Jews of Poland. No one in late 1941 had thought of taking Jews from Bordeaux all the way to Eastern Europe to kill them. That simply was in nobody's minds. Now, it begs the question of what would have happened to those Jews, of course. And counterfactual thinking is always a bit dodgy. But certainly, the Vichy regime had no intention of allowing Jews to be deported or deporting Jews other than foreign Jews and Jews that didn't particularly want. But, as Paul said, I want you to think about this. I'm not kind of laying down the law or saying this is what all historians think, but it causes us to look again.
Does anybody have to take up one more question? Does anybody have one further kind of quick question for Professor Cesarani?
Or even a longish question, and I'll answer it quickly.
I'm not a specialist as a childhood interest in World War II, but that's about it. But at what point is the final solution inevitable, if you like? At what point are the wheels set in motion after which we're in a different thing? I mean, I was thinking in terms of von Stauffenberg, Bonaparte, 1944, and the earlier resistance measures. You know, when does the point come, other than the early 1942? Is that the deciding point, or is that just the decision to do things?
Right. How about we'll take very quickly, yeah.
Well, so I was just going to write, equally, I'm a non-historian in this regard, but had the thousand-year Reich actually been established, what future would the Jewish community have had long-term?
Okay, those are both really interesting and very important questions. To take the last question first, and again, it's sort of counterfactual thinking.
Yeah.
if the war had ended with Germany occupying Moscow in November 1941, Jews would probably have been shoved out of the Reich, either deported across the Urals, dumped there, or allowed to emigrate out of Europe to anywhere else that they could go or that would have them. We might have seen a kind of exodus similar to the one that we see on our television screens of people getting onto boats and trying to reach North Africa or other places. They might have decided to build extermination camps and kill them all. But there was no decision, no sign of that. So now we come to the second question. When does it become inevitable? When is the decision made? Well, historians argue about that. No one has discovered the document that says it was on that day that a decision was made by Hitler or anybody else. All we can do is piece together the fragments of evidence and to see where things converge. But I think it's very significant that when the Germans build dedicated so-called death camps, extermination camps, in Poland, they're the wrong size. They're too small. Chełmno is improvised. It's a few gas fans shuffling backwards and forwards, and it's shut down after about 12 months because it couldn't cope with very large numbers. That's not what it was for. The gas chambers at Belzec are pulled down and rebuilt after they get several weeks after they start operating in I think it's late May, early June 1942. A similar thing happens at Treblinka. The first commandant of Treblinka discovers that the conception of the camp is, you know, wrong. It can't do what it's supposed to do, which was mainly to destroy the Jews of Warsaw. And it has to be shut down for nearly a week for them to completely rethink the procedure. Sobibor was shut down for several weeks because the rail track couldn't deal with the volume of traffic going backwards and forwards. So they hadn't thought this through. They had not thought through a genocide of such massive proportions. And now we come to Auschwitz-Birkenau. Auschwitz-Birkenau is not in play in 1941. And in 1942, when gas chambers are built there, they are converted peasant huts. Again, it's improvised at very short notice. And then a decision is made to make Auschwitz-Birkenau a focus for the extermination operation. So underground mortuaries are converted to gas chambers and two above-ground gas chambers are constructed. They are ready to go into operation in March 1943. And no one arrives. Because the Germans had, during 1942, annihilated the populations they could easily get their hands on. After that time, it was a bit of a struggle for them. I don't think we need to feel sorry for Eichmann, but the job got a lot harder. So even though a decision had definitely decisively been made, the equipment was all there, actually implementing it was very difficult, and German policy changed. Because by the spring of 1943, the Reich is suffering from a terrible labour shortage, and the folks in the east point out, you know, these Jews we just killed, they could be working for us, and maybe we shouldn't be so profligate with these Jewish populations, which is why the Lodz ghetto, with 70,000 Jews on it, chugs on through 1943 and into 1944, into August 1944. So, even though the decision is made, And finally, Stauffenberg. Oh, I love Tom Cruise. And I think Valkyrie is pretty good film. It's one of the films in which he doesn't have a ridiculous hairdo, although the patch is, doesn't look quite right. In that film, they make the pretense that the military conspirators were trying to kill Hitler partly because of what was happening to the Jews. It's not true. Stauffenberg had been on the Eastern Front for months during Operation Barbarossa, wading through hell, and hadn't blinked an eyelid. An interesting counterfactualist asked, what would have happened to the Jews in the Third Reich in Europe had the plotters succeeded in 1943 when they made their first attempt at Hitler's life? Well, we know from their documents that the Jews would still not have been restored to their full civil rights. That they still would have preferred Jewish emigration from the Reich, because even these anti-Nazis did not think of German Jews as proper citizens of the Reich. What went on in other countries, that was their business. Jews were simply not a priority. So another tragedy of the situation is not only that the plotters failed in 1943 and again in July 1944, but that even these men who were honourable and good and brave men, when it came to the Jews, had a blind spot. And that is another one of the reasons why the Jewish fate is so catastrophic, because there was no one prepared to go out on a limb within the military in Germany, and there's a kind of mirror image in the Allied armies.
Okay, I think we'd all like to ask you a lot more questions. I've certainly got notes, but we're already sort of 50 minutes over your sort of allotted slot, I'm afraid. But I think maybe just one last round of applause for a really fascinating... Okay, now I want to sort of move us on to the next element of the afternoon. A bit like we had the input from the multi-faith chaplaincy team, various different...